Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, going directly into the show, April 2nd, 2009. And if this were April 1st, maybe I'd start out a show like this. NASA announced that it has failed at 90% of the projects it has attempted. Its current space program, they have announced, is a failure because it does not ever plan to get any number of people into space. It plans to prevent people from getting into space by spending all of our space national resources to get one man into space and maybe one man possibly to Mars in the next 30 years, but they can't do it anyway because they don't know how to deal with the radiation fields. And lastly, NASA admits that comets are not dirty snowballs. But anyway, since today is not April 1st, I'd say April Fools, and of course life would go back to normal. At any rate, many announcements tonight, and the main science topic tonight, I'll be dealing with some of the conditions in the solar system. So especially the solar wind and how that creates the conditions for our electric field, etc. In the process of talking about the solar conditions, I have to also talk about some of the conditions in the science world. It's very difficult dealing with scientists today because they are compartmentalized. A condition made by degrees, by advanced degrees, where someone specializes to get their PhD. And once they're in that field, that's all they can do. They can't talk about any other field because there are specialists over there in that field that supposedly know way more than anybody else. And so as these fields become narrower and narrower, that's a hard word to say for me, it's like a star. If you can imagine the points as we draw out a star, like one of those figures that kids draw out of a star, and it's got points on it. As the points develop and become narrower and narrower, it's more difficult for the people at those pinnacles of their particular specialty, it's more difficult for them to communicate. In fact, I would say it's safe to say they don't communicate at all. It's fun to go around at some of the scientific meetings and see what everybody else is doing, but say you get 10, 15,000 scientists in a building, most of them are concentrating on their particular specialty. And let me just give you an example of how esoteric it might be. Someone is studying and has spent years studying, let's say, the upper atmosphere and an exchange of ions between the upper ionosphere and just the edge of outer space. And they're watching these. They're possibly, after many years, get a satellite that can look at that region, or possibly send a sounding rocket through that region, or possibly use ground-based remote sensing equipment to look at that particular area, maybe in conjunction with other satellites receiving data from solar storms, etc. And so that's how specialized, that's how narrow a focus people can be. So how can you possibly talk to people about the overall conditions in the solar system? And then you've got microgroups like at NASA, at Goddard, at JPL, who still are talking dirty snowball comet model. They're still locked in theories that were around literally in the 1950s. So at any rate, I'm going to talk about the conditions, the electrical conditions in the solar system, how they form, and some of the scientific principles involved, but also talk about the difficulties in dealing with the scientific community when it comes to enlightening them regarding these particular scientific concepts. And the point of that is to give people a bit of an insight into my daily life as a scientist, and attempting to create a new scientific structure out of the old one, getting rid of some things that shouldn't be there. As for example, last week I talked about general relativity and experiments which conclusively proved that general relativity was totally incorrect. That's not special relativity, that's general relativity, which deals with the gravitational fields around stars. And of course, I've talked about that many times before. Anyway, before going into the main science topic, I have a few quick announcements. The corn seed offer ended, and there's no more corn available, just to let people know, especially on the radio. Of course, it's no longer available on the webpage. But if you missed the corn order, then that's it. It's all gone. That particular corn seed stock is gone and completely sold out. So, but for the people that did get that, plant it this spring, follow the instructions, take your crop. By the way, corn seed is one of those seeds that does not store well over long periods of time. And so you can store it and continue the germination, but the point is, plant it as soon as possible and then start generating your own annual stock of seeds. That's the best thing you can do with that. And then you'll have some to eat, some to grind, some to feed to animals and birds or chickens, whatever. But plant the seed this year, and hopefully everybody out there will have a bountiful crop, and propagate that and give some of the seed to your friends. Remember that when you're saving seeds, especially from corn, you don't take one ear of corn and save all of the ears. What you do is you take, say, an ear of corn and save 20 seeds from that ear, and then you go to the next ear, and then you save 20 seeds from that ear, and on and on. And so you take some of the dried corn from each cob that is produced, and you take a little bit of corn off of each cob, and that keeps a very strength, a very strong genetic strain in the corn seed that goes into the ground next year. And then the rest of it, of course, you grind up for food or whatever, and then or give away to friends to so they have corn seed, etc. And in a given plot, you want at least 200 to 250 seeds to have a good genetic strain. If you have less than that, the corn can start to lose its genetic strength, and eventually it will not produce good corn seed. So, at any rate, that's just a few tips if you did have the corn. And, of course, it's all in the instructions. But one quick point. The other day I went to the bird feed store, and I thought, well, I'll buy some bird feed. And I looked at the bag. I bought some. I just threw it in the cart, brought it home. And I look on the bag, and I had cracked corn, which is corn that's kind of chopped up into big pieces. Right on the top of the bag, it said, not for human consumption. Where have we heard those words before? I've talked about that repeatedly. Not for human consumption. And this was grown right in the Midwest here. Of course, what that means is there are so many chemicals sprayed on and sprayed in that corn while it was growing, and then after it was harvested, so many chemicals from the day that that seed was brought in and created and through its entire lifetime crunched up and then put in a bag, there were so many chemicals sprayed on that that it is not fit for human consumption. And I went through the entire corn research project last spring, that's the one thing I found out, that the majority of corn grown in the United States, all those beautiful fields of corn, if you went out and picked one of those ears of corn to eat, it would make you sick, probably give you cancer, which is another topic I got coming up here in a minute. Then I also bought some safflower seeds, and I looked on the package of that. That's something you feed. Squirrels don't like safflowers, so a lot of times you can attract birds with safflower and keep the squirrels away. So anyway, I bought some safflower. On that bag also, it said, for bird feed only, not intended for any other use. In other words, don't eat it. Don't make anything out of this. Don't try and grow it. so this is our what's being grown in the United States. It all looks like food, but none of it is fit for human consumption. Okay, enough of that. That's why basically you have to be your own source of food today and fresh water. It's been a number of weeks since I've talked about the Dalton water filters. And of course, they're on the webpage. I won't go into a lot of detail, but some people have been asking, and it's a very good question, what happens if the water filters freeze? And of course, they contain water. So I called the manufacturer. I already knew what the answer was, but I wanted to double check. And here is the answer. If you own a Dalton water filter, and I'm sure this applies to most water filters on the market, that, of course, water freezes, it expands and contracts, of course, when it freezes and thaws. And so the bottom line is it breaks things. Water is one of those few things that when it freezes, it tends to break things. So the bottom line is if you are going to encounter freezing conditions, you know, especially with the stainless steel container, and then also the filter elements. Just pour the water out before it freezes. And then the filter elements also dry them out as well as possible. And here's how you would do that. You just take them out, let them drip for about the first 10 minutes. They're going to just drip water because they're saturated. They're literally like a sponge, totally saturated with water. And then put them on a warm source, some kind of a warm, maybe 100 degrees, you know, something like where your furnace, your air duct from your furnace or a warm radiator or something, where they will warm up and that water will evaporate out of them relatively quickly and before they freeze. But if they do freeze, there's a chance that the ceramic shell or the plastic casing where it attaches, the ceramic shell attaches to the base, those could break or separate or something like that. So bottom line, you don't want the filter elements to freeze with water in them. They can certainly freeze if they're dry. And that's the amazing thing about these water filtration systems. If you buy your extra filter elements, then you store those. You can store those any place, and they can freeze 100 times, it won't affect them, and then they're ready for use someday, you know, down the line in the future. That's why it's good to have, I consider having a lot of filter elements, an essential part of having a water filter system, like the Dalton, because who knows, with the way the world is going today, you know, you might be using this in 20 years. You might be the only guy around with clean water. So, at any rate, having spares is a good idea. And, of course, you can get the spares. They're $89.95 for two extra Dalton ceramic. They're called Super Sterisil 7-inch water filters. Those are the ones that go in all the units I sell. Not a bad idea to have an extra set of those. And let me just quick give the mail order address. It's JMCC. P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. And get some extra filter elements, and of course, they're on the webpage. On to the next topic. Did you know, this is super interesting, Denmark, little country up on the northern tip of Europe, Denmark, generated 100% of its electric energy this past week, one day, 100% of its electric energy generated from wind power. And guess what? On the best day ever in the United States, far less than 1% of our energy was developed with wind power. Now, if we had started developing wind power decades ago, where would we be? We could be generating vast amounts. And look at what we use to generate electricity. Primarily coal, also natural gas, the same energy source that many people heat their house with. You are competing in a very inefficient process, the generation of electricity. And one time I did a study for a company, and they wanted to know the efficiency of electrical generation. So let's look at it this way. Let's take that coal that comes by train and then is delivered to, let's say, the Midwest or out east for coal generation. That comes by train, huge trains that do nothing but truck the coal from the Montana and Wyoming coal fields, primarily, and of course there's some coal fields out in the east too, Virginia, of course, and Pennsylvania, those areas. But at any rate, I did an analysis for a company, and they wanted to know the efficiency of electrical generation. So I went right from the beginning, from when the coal is dug out of the ground, put on the train, transported to the electrical generation plant, burned, generated into electricity, and then transported over the high voltage wires to the source, broken down into lower voltages, and then delivered, and then run through. And since about 60% of our electrical energy is consumed by industrial motors, I use the industrial motor as the baseline, and it's about the same for the efficiency for most other electrical products, including light bulbs are far worse, actually, the standard incandescent light bulb, that is. But at any rate, I did an analysis and showed that only 5% of the energy from that coal or natural gas actually gets to become useful work. 5%. That means 95% is wasted along that entire route from being dug up, transported, burned, the process of converting heat into electricity, transporting that over the high tension wires, then moving through a lower voltage distribution center transformer out to the electric motor in industrial site. Only 5% of that energy goes into useful work. How incredibly wasteful. At any rate, I'm not going to dwell on that, but Denmark this past week generated 100% of its electrical daily requirement from wind power. I just can't believe the waste and the destruction going on in the earth these days due to the energy industry, the greed, the destruction, the loss of human dignity, the wars in foreign countries over money. Right now, by the way, the U.S. dollar, the only thing that shores it up is the fact that most countries are forced to deal in dollars when they trade in oil. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that tonight. By the way, the Chicago Sun-Times this past week is the latest paper to go into bankruptcy. Newspapers are dropping like flies out there. Nobody reads them anymore. Who picks up a newspaper and reads it for the news that happened yesterday when you already know all the news today? And of course, you can go online and get it for free if you trust the news source. And I'll get into that in just a second. Who owns the news? I'm going to give a brief analysis of that. But let me read one of the headlines or some of the headlines from CNN. This I just pulled up last Tuesday just as an example. Here's CNN. Here's the headlines. Here's a world, we live in a world where there's economic chaos. Countries are going bankrupt. Zimbabwe is in a huge mess. There's about 20% of the United States population is unemployed. Okay. Here's the CNN webpage, CNN.com, headlines. naked pole vaulter runs city streets. Oh, that's something everybody should know about, right? Baby alligator wanders into house, bites guy. Look at this. This is the headlines on CNN.com. This is incredible. So it's no small wonder that the Chicago Sun-Times or any newspaper is going bankrupt. Let me just, as long as I'm on this topic, this past week, a lot came out about the bailout. And, of course, everybody is angry as they can be about this, knowing that, like, Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, the current Treasury Secretary, was a staff member on the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations, and then he served on the New York City Federal Reserve Bank, the Fed, out of the, one of the main core banks of the Fed in New York City, and then becomes Treasury Secretary. He also served under Alan Greenspan on the Fed, and of course the Federal Reserve is an independent bank, has nothing to do with the federal government. But at any rate, I'm not going to go into that. The TARP money and all of the other bailout money going to basically companies that Timothy Geithner used to work for or was associated with through the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a private company that receives fundings from the likes of Goldman Sachs, AIG, and all of the rest of the corporations that got money for the bailout. But now here's what I want to go and talk about. These companies, these major companies, own the news media. So the TARP money went to entities. Look at who owns the news out there. The Council of Foreign Relations has as its members, and by the way, this is where TARP money went to and bailout money, Bloomberg, of course, is a large news agency. General Electric, who owns NBC, CNBC, and MSNBC. Gee, making good things come to life there, huh, GE? The News Corporation, which owns Fox and Fox Business News, and then Standard & Poor's owns ABC News. Time Warner owns CNN, Time Magazine, and a whole laundry list of news agencies. There's Moody's, and then McGraw-Hill Publishing Company. All of these companies were in line for bailout money and are owned by the big corporations that got TARP bailout money. Who owns the news? Who's in business? You see private entities like the Chicago Sun-Times going out of business. They didn't get TARP money, but they, of course, are not owned necessarily directly by these major corporations. So when you turn on the evening news, understand who owns the news and who's writing the news stories for your listening enjoyment and also your disinformation. So that's why people, more and more people listen to this show, because they want real news. This is an amazing announcement this past week. Tesla, the company out of California, founded and funded by Elon Musk, he's the CEO, and of course they came out with that amazing Roadster last year and sold out. They had, how many versions of that did they have? Units? I don't remember the exact number, but they sold out. At any rate, Tesla has announced that it is coming out with a sedan to be mass marketed, coming off the assembly line, they say, in 2011. So an all-electric car capable of 300 miles on a charge and costing approximately $50,000. Now imagine the savings that you're going to have over the course of the lifetime of this car, by not having to go in for oil changes and all kinds of lubrication changes for the engine. The only moving part is a single electric motor that'll probably outlast you and your kids and your kids' kids and your children's children, etc. This is monumental because the point is Detroit had decades to come up with something like this. Here's an outfit that's been in business 2 years and has a sedan that's meant for the general public, completely electric. This is not a hybrid. This is a completely electric car for $50,000. And as they mass produce them, and as other cars come online, Detroit is simply going to be a word of the past. And if I were a Detroit worker, I would be wondering what's going on in the minds of the CEOs of those corporations, because they were actually locked in with the oil companies to produce gas-guzzling vehicles and strap us to this huge expense of automobiles that has basically sucked this country dry from the inside out. Here's an interesting topic, and just one last thing here. Scientists, for the first time, saw an asteroid as it was in outer space and were able to photograph it to get a spectral, to do a spectral analysis on it and determine its spectral signature. And then the object crashed into the atmosphere. It didn't do any damage. It landed harmlessly up in the Sudan desert, and they went out and picked up a couple hundred pieces of this, and now they're able to analyze the rocks, the pieces that broke up when this exploded, when it hit the atmosphere. They were able to analyze the pieces of this and then compare it to the spectral signature that they were able to measure before it came into the atmosphere. So, very exciting, and I know quite a few scientists that work in that field who analyze the spectral signatures of asteroids out there, and that's a very interesting field. A lot of new, very exciting work going on in that field, so my hat's off to those people. I do complain about standard science a lot, but it's the overall structure of science, and a lot of these scientists are stuck working in it because it's the only game in town, but a lot of great work going on with the studying of asteroids, their spectral conditions, and trying to analyze the properties of these wanderers that are all over our solar system. And of course, my view on those is that the vast majority have been captured into this solar system and come from solar systems or exploded stars or from beyond our own solar system. And of course, many of them could be part, as some scientists claim, an exploded planet. And that's very possible in a solar system as dynamic as ours, that eventually an entire planet could be smashed by an incoming object. And of course, what I say is a near miss is much more likely. And so the near misses are the ones that turn the planet upside down, cause the mass extinctions worldwide, the global flooding, the changing of our atmosphere, so many properties of our world that change on a moment's notice. And so at any rate, on to the main science topic. Just one last quick note. I want to recap March as being the month, as I predicted. I said as Venus moves around to inferior conjunction, we would have a normal March. And that's very true. The 27th of March was the inferior conjunction of Venus. And here's what happens. Venus has a long comet-like tail that extends out from the sun. And, of course, Earth is the next planet out. And so, as Venus moves around between us and the sun, its tail, which is sticking out behind the sun, we pass through that. And in doing so, we also pick up a pretty good electrical connection, which increases the electrical flow past Earth and increases our weather, our severe weather, etc. And so it was very easy to predict that March would be, especially late March, would be very winter-like. And, of course, it very much has been. If you live in the Northwest, the Midwest states, or even out east, March has been the typical old-fashioned type of March, where the winter just isn't giving up. And, of course, the fact that Venus is here this year is rather unusual, but also on the 26th of March, we had the new moon. So a couple days after that, we definitely got the severe weather from that little piece of the puzzle. So anyway, that prediction was fairly easy to make. And, of course, I made that repeatedly quite some time ago, back in February. I said, yep, March is going to be a standard, old-fashioned March, wintry and blustery, and that's exactly what we got. On to the main science topic. Last week, I ended the show by talking about general relativity and specifically some data that was taken by a Venus orbiter satellite. And just quickly in summary, in 1919, general relativity was considered proven by an experiment where some astronomers, Dyson and Eddington from England, went to tropical locations and did some telescope work and then tried to determine the bending of light around our sun. So they took a picture of a star field without the sun there, then they had to take the same picture of that same star field, but with the sun directly in the middle, and it just happened that Dyson was an expert on predicting solar eclipses. So this was a time during solar eclipse, so they had to go to the tropics to be at the center of the total solar eclipse. And then took a picture with the moon completely blotting out the sun and of the same star field. And then there was a very complicated set of calculations and data maneuvering that they had to do to come up with the fact and say, yes, starlight does bend around the sun. And there's no question that it does. But as I said last week, in 1979, I was at Cornell and some new data had come in from the Venus orbiter. That was around the running around Venus at that time, in orbit around Venus. And here's what happened. As Venus passed around behind the sun, and the orbiter, of course, was with it, they knew exactly where that orbiter was. Very sound, standard physics. And then they took a radio telescope and started monitoring the direction of the signal from that artificial satellite orbiting Venus. And what happened is, on a very low time scale, a very short time scale, the signal from the satellite was very erratic, moving back and forth. And so the meeting I went to was all the scientists there were trying to analyze the data. And as I said last week, there were astrophysicists, astronomers, space scientists, and physicists, all of them fully aware of the implications of this data, basically disproving general relativity. And when the meeting broke up, nobody wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So this week, I wanted to continue on with another set of data that went the same route. And this was back in the 1986 era when Comet Halley came through the solar system on its 71-year cycle. I think it's 71-year cycle that Halley's comet moves on. So anyway, some scientists got equipment. Interestingly enough, they went to Latin America. They went to South America to take some spectral analysis of Halley's comet. And in the process, discovered after they got back and analyzed their data, all of the data they had taken was redshifted. And so what a strange thing, because the redshift is only due, this is standard modern physics talking, that is, the only possible mechanisms known to standard science, that is, to cause a redshift would be, number one, special relativity, which predicts a redshift if an object is moving away from you, and these objects have to move quite fast for it to be detectable on a scale, type of scale that we were dealing with here. And obviously, Halley's Comet was in a known orbit. It wasn't moving away from them at some accelerated rate or high velocity. And so that could not have been the cause of the redshift. The only other possible cause, according to standard science, would be general relativity. Basically, there is a belief that a very massive object would cause a redshift of light leaving it based on general relativity, the curvature of space-time. And basically, the mass of object, the mass, would attract the photon back towards it, and so that would reduce the energy of the photon, causing a redshift. Well, clearly, Halley's Comet was a little teeny poof ball without sufficient mass to cause any kind of a redshift. And so the data that they took, they, you know, certainly had all the data to determine what kind of elements were in the comet, the various chemicals that they could determine, their spectral lines, etc. But everything was redshifted. That means that on the photographic plate, as the light came through the spectral analyzer, it was all shifted towards the red end of the spectrum. So there was no way to reconcile this with known physics. So what did they do? They dumped the data. This is another perfect example of scientists looking at something that obviously brought into question general relativity, obviously brought into question the fact that there had to be some other source of redshift out there. And part of what I did back in the 70s when I was working on my theoretical work, I realized that there had to be a complete restructuring of basic physics. And all of this came out for many other reasons. If you look at my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, in the appendix are the three, what we call the three-part comet paper. That's the paper that I wrote based on a larger book that I wrote back in the late 70s dealing with basically this restructuring of physics. And so not only did there have to be a number of basic changes in fundamental physics principles, but there had to be some changes in how we deal with the solar system. So, and of course, when I heard about the data coming from Halley's Comet, that's something that I had actually predicted. And it was predicted long before, 6 years or more before, the Halley's Comet experiment. Of course, I didn't know that these guys would get equipment, go down and make this measurement. I only saw their data after they brought it back and heard about the redshift in their data. But basically, I said that the comets would produce a larger significant redshift, and I actually identified some experiments that could show the difference between dirty snowball comet theory and my plasma discharge comet model theory that dealt with the electrical nature of comets. And of course, if you have something that's highly electrically charged, then it's going to produce a redshift, and I produced the theory that would explain it, called the induced electric dipole redshift. I won't go into that on the show because it's a rather complicated topic. But now, last week I ended the show by saying that general relativity is very difficult to prove because you cannot get giant massive objects into your laboratory. You can't get a quasar. You can't get a black hole into your laboratory. So the only way to test for general relativity is by looking out into space and looking for external signs. And so all over, let's take another example. Scientists say they can detect X-ray sources in outer space, and they say that must be a black hole because X-rays would be produced at the edge as particles go accelerating in across the timeline into the black hole. They would accelerate and produce X-rays. And so scientists say, oh, this is a signature of a black hole. Well, in Now, it is coined, a term I coined in my papers, the electrical universe. That's coined, that's another term you can see in my papers that I coined long ago. And it explains that many of the scientific topics, the theories that are being explained due to gravity, are really due to the electrical conditions in the universe. And so this is where I'm going to break off for just a second and talk about scientists who've learned something in a book. A lot of them with PhDs. They went through their PhD program. They learned about general relativity. They learned about the gravitational effects in space. They learned that space should not be electrically active because of some very interesting properties, that if you had an electric charge in space, very quickly it would be neutralized. And in fact, that's exactly what a comet is. It's a charged object that's in the middle of an electrical discharge, and space is trying to become electrically neutral, and the comet is the personification of that particular concept. So you have to understand that the sun, the stars, any fusion object out there is producing a solar wind of particles. And a lot of scientists can't take the mental leap and understand how this happens, because there's a vast difference between these little textbook problems and reality. Most of the textbook problems only deal with a point source in space. And the trick is understanding all of the physics that goes into the separation of charge, which occurs around a quasar, a galactic nucleus, or a star like our own, and understanding the flow of particles. Now let's go to another concept that is the heart. One of the core theories of standard traditional astrophysics is that the fusion of the sun is at the core, because that's the only mechanism that they could imagine back in the 30s and the 40s when they were doing their calculations relative to the... They knew how much heat was coming out of the sun. And remember, back then they considered the surface of the sun to be a smooth heat-generating surface, a black body, so to speak, at around 6,000 degrees. And so the only thing they could imagine was that the core was so dense that that was the physical property that kicked off the fusion that created the intense heat that we see pouring out of the sun. But the problem is that there are some major physical flaws that come up, little pieces of data, and one of them is very recognizable, that there's a very basic set of calculations dealing with a particle called a neutrino. If the core of the sun is generating heat and nuclear fusion at the rate they say it is, then there should be a number of neutrinos passing out, and those should be detectable at Earth. And they are not in the quantities that are specified by nuclear theory. And there's been a huge, vast amount of effort by scientists to try and patch up this data. And now let's go back to the general relativity meeting I was in. Remember that the scientists, as I said last week, when the Venus orbiter data came in, the entire meeting was about how you could take that data and patch it up to comply with general relativity instead of looking at the obvious. The data contradicted general relativity. Some very basic physics had to be changed to accommodate this data. And what did the scientists do? They walked away and nobody said a word. Why? Because you're dealing with scientists who learn something that's incorrect. It's in their brains, and if you talk to them about this, and I've experienced this dozens of times, when you talked about scientists about changing those fundamentals, their brain goes blank. They can't talk. Nothing computes. Their brain literally shuts down. When scientists hide data and bend to peer pressure because they are afraid to talk and be the one who says, hey, this data contradicts everything we know. We have to make some fundamental changes. Now let's go back to the star I was talking about in the beginning and people in specialties. Everybody, all of the PhD scientists, they're working at their university, they're working in the government lab, they're out in their little teeny point of their specialty. And they're going to say, well, I can't talk to all those people over there because they're in their specialty. And if I tried to change my specialty to accommodate this, then nobody else would be in sync with us. So I better just shut up, collect my funding, publish my papers, and life will be good. And that's what happens. So the whole idea of compartmentalization of science, of specialization, scientists being so narrow in their focus, they cannot backtrack, come back to the center hub, which is inclusive of all the scientific branches, and say, hey guys, let's all get in this room because we got a big problem. And that's why I, as an independent scientist, didn't have to deal with any of that. So while I was working with these scientists all around me on a daily basis, they couldn't move. They couldn't think. Their brain was locked, and they were out here. And I was able to sit down and say, okay, physics on a fundamental basis needs some restructuring. So what happens if general relativity goes away? What are the two things that you have to account for? You have to account for the bending of light and the redshift, which are associated with light conditions around a gravitational object, and you have to deal with the precession of Mercury. That's one of the theoretical or experimental proofs, so-called proofs, of the theory of general relativity. So if you now have an electrical condition around a star that's causing these effects, proving the electrical redshift and the electrical bending of light was very easy. In fact, this is something that even a grade schooler could do, or somebody in high school or in college physics. It's an experiment that I've done quite a few times with college students. And you basically can create a very high voltage source using a Tesla generator, they're called, and they produce a very high voltage at the head of a very small point, almost like a nail point. And you can shine a laser beam across the top of that, and you can see the laser beam cycling, bending down with the variation in the voltage on the pinhead. So literally, unlike general relativity, you can prove the induced electric dipole redshift. You can prove it in the laboratory. So at any rate, now you have something that is provable in the laboratory, but scientists still are remiss. They don't want to leave that ground that they're standing on. Let's make it a comparable to somebody who's in an earthquake. The ground beneath your feet, many times you assume that that's very stable. It's always going to be there. But people who've lived through a serious earthquake, let's put it this way, they are very nervous. Whenever the ground shakes, you can see those people lock up and they get extremely nervous because they know that the earth can change underneath their feet. Well, the scientists in universities, the people with PhDs, the scientists who go to these meetings, typically have never been in a mental earthquake where their basis has been shaken and where they had to basically recover from a severe psychological earthquake. And that would be the equivalent of these scientists dealing with a change where general relativity had to go. Look at all of the work. Look at all of the popular topics that have come out, black holes. And, everybody thinks there's a black hole at the center of our galaxy. And all of the popular press that has expounded on black holes. Look at the vast amount of theoretical work that has been done relative to general relativity. But it all comes back to a basic assumption that Einstein made. It's called the principle of equivalence. The principle of equivalence states that if you do an experiment in a gravitational system, like on the surface of the sun or the surface of the earth, all of the experimental results should act the same as if you were in an elevator accelerating at the same rate as the gravitational acceleration at the surface of the earth or the sun or the equivalent. So at any rate, Einstein created what they call in German a Gedanken experiment. That's a thought experiment, and there are many examples in physics of Gedanken experiments, thought experiments. So the idea was that you could make predictions that a gravitational body that was massive enough, like our sun, should then, if you did experiments in outer space with light in an accelerated environment, like in a rocket ship that was accelerating, then all of the experiments should be the equivalent of doing them on the surface of the sun. Thus the red shift, thus the bending of light around the sun. The only problem is nobody has ever come up with the theoretical connection between electromagnetism and gravity. And that is, many times you hear a phrase, it is called the grand unification of the fields. We have nuclear forces. We have electrical forces between charged particles and charged objects, and then there is gravity. And of course, the idea of the grand unification of the fields that many scientists are working on is to associate one of the biggest dead ends that has ever been there and it has never been resolved, is the association between gravity and electromagnetism, light, electric fields, magnetic fields. What is the association? Well, we have all kinds of examples. For example, charged objects in outer space that still follow gravitational principles very exactly. And so how does this work? For example, if gravity were related to electrical conditions, the Earth is very shielded by our own very large magnetic field and electric fields up in the ionosphere. So if gravity was somehow related to electromagnetic fields, then the orbits would be very different because Earth is very shielded electrically and magnetically from outer space. So if we had an artificial satellite in orbit around the Earth, it would basically follow a very different orbit, if not simply go flying off into space and never come back. But these orbits follow very strict gravitational orbits. So in other words, gravity sees through the shielding that electric and magnetic forces cannot see through. You see what I mean? So there's a lot of people, mainly clowns on the internet, who go, gravity is related to electricity. Well, it's really not. And you can prove in about a dozen different ways that gravity is not related to electromagnetism. So the point is, here we are, we go back to general relativity, and there is a giant vacuum in the theoretical picture relating or trying to relate gravity to electromagnetism. So this is what I ended last week's show with. I said Einstein, in his later years, he actually wrote a book, it's called Out of My Later Years by Albert Einstein. And one of the most famous sentences in there, and I quote this in my papers, is that he said, he didn't believe general relativity because it didn't include the total field. In other words, it didn't include electricity and magnetism. In other words, how could the sun, gravity, affect bending of light and redshifting when there was no known effect for the electric and magnetic fields of the sun to affect gravity or to affect the light passing by or the light leaving the sun? How could that be? And he wondered about that, and that actually spurred the entire topic of the grand unification of the fields. And as I said, there is a vast theoretical empty box in the science world. In other words, there's no theoretical verification, there's no laboratory verification that the principle of equivalence has any truth to it at all. And that's the entire basis of general relativity. It's one of those things where you make an assumption and go and go and go. It's in mathematics, it's very much like the Riemann hypothesis, where mathematicians, thank goodness, are a little more strict with themselves, but they've allowed themselves to prove many, 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 many things if the Riemann hypothesis is true. And so the great effort in mathematics is to try and prove the Riemann hypothesis, which deals with prime numbers, another topic that, of course, I've done a lot of work on, made some major advances in that field. But unfortunately, in physics, the physicists have not been that diligent in protecting and stating the reality that everything in general relativity and all the developments, all the mathematical development would be true if the principle of equivalence is true. And as I said, there's no direct laboratory proof. There is no theoretical structure to link gravity and electromagnetism, especially electromagnetic waves, which is light. So, now let's go back to the Halley's Comet experiment, the spectroscopy experiment done back in 1986 by scientists who went to South America to try and determine the spectral properties of Halley's Comet and determined there was a redshift. All of their data produced a redshift. So, once again, here we have scientists basically hiding data that would conclusively prove that there's something amiss in the world of the redshift. The scientific theoretical work revolving around special relativity, general relativity, and some third concept, which, in fact, is what I discovered and published. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift, and it deals with light and the electrical dipole properties of light. And that is the true cause of bending of light around the sun. It's the true cause of redshifts, and that's, now let's go into another topic, the expanding universe. The Big Bang is not true because, once again, there is another source of redshift. Next week, I'll take up a couple other topics dealing with these very deep, but also topics that affect your daily life, because it all comes back to the solar system, the electrical nature of the solar system, which produces our daily weather and many other effects, including the way we will see Planet X, if there ever is one in the solar system, as a large, giant comet. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.